Well, I'd like to welcome you to this discussion and examination that we're going to do today, looking into some of the teachings of Dr. R.C. Sproul in regards to the last days or prophetic passages from the Bible. And as you may know, Dr. Sproul is a very influential theologian, and he's the one that spearheaded and founded the Ligonier Ministries, which puts out a lot of excellent teaching materials. But as we'll see as we look at some of these aspects of his teaching, when it comes to prophetic passages and aspects having to do with predictions in the Bible about the last days, I think there are some significant shortcomings to his insights that are misleading, and that's the purpose of this presentation. Recently, Ligonier Ministries radio broadcast, which is called Renewing Your Mind, featured a series of audio teachings on aspects of the prophetic teachings of the Bible. Topics such as the Book of Revelation, the Antichrist, the Beast, the Rapture, and the Millennium. And these were presented in a series of 5 messages on their program. And we're going to take a look at each one of those messages and include, you know, direct clips, sound bites, if you will, from each of those. And we're going to look at each of the conclusions and things that he says in light of Scripture and a little broader view of the prophetic passages in the Bible. And my concern here is to show several things. One is I want you to be able to see that Sproul's commitment to preterism biases his interpretation. And because he has this commitment to a preterist understanding of Scripture, in other words, that many of the passages that we would consider to be still future events, he wants to see them as being fulfilled in the first century. And because of that commitment to that belief, he ends up distorting an understanding of eschatology, that is, the study of last things. And this is very ironic in particular because he has written a book called The Last Days According to Jesus. And the ironic aspect of that is he's trying to tell us what he thinks the last days are according to Jesus, but what he actually ends up doing is giving us a rendition of the last days according to Sproul, and quite different from, I'm quite sure, different than what Jesus would have us understand about the last days. But as we proceed forward in this presentation, I do want to say that Dr. Sproul is an amazing teacher. He has many excellent qualities. I've learned a lot from him myself. I think when it comes to certain topics like the Reformation, church history, philosophy, and some other aspects, the doctrines of grace, as the Reformed covenant theologians call the ideas that came forth from some of the Reformation teachers, he is outstanding, especially in areas having to do with early church councils or Roman Catholicism and its understanding and abuses of Scripture. He's hard to beat on those topics. But when you come to eschatology, I think we'll see that he stumbles pretty seriously in that area. And in this, he's very similar to the Bible answer man, Hank Hanegraaff. He has a similar awesome qualities and can really handle certain areas, but when it comes to prophecy, both of these guys have some serious problems. So we have 2 main goals in our discussion today. One is to understand the flawed reasoning and interpretation concerning prophetic passages that are taught by Dr. Sproul and, in general, preterists. But secondly, also to discern the ways in which teachers can go astray. When we look at some of the teachings and things he's going to say, it's one thing to see the problems with what he's saying, and it's another to identify the type of error he's making. And I think both of those things are important. It's important to understand what's wrong, how it should be correctly understood, but also discern why is it that he goes astray and what emphasis is he putting on something that leads him astray. I think both of those things are valuable to try and discern. And of course, what we're going to do is check what he has to say against the scriptures. And of course, that's what we want to do with all teachers, including me. I hope that you're doing that with my teaching as well. And we are reminded, of course, of the passage in Acts chapter 17, verses 10 and 11, where we read that the brethren immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. And when they arrived, they went into the synagogue of the Jews, and these were more fair-minded than those in Thessalonica, and that they received the word with all readiness and searched the scriptures daily to find out whether these things are so. And that's what we want to do too. We want to be good Bereans, search the scriptures. And I think one of the reasons that Dr. Sproul's teaching in areas of eschatology can be fairly influential, of course he has a huge platform in the broadcasting publishing area, but also if you don't have a comprehensive grasp of prophetic passages, he can put focus on a certain area and make a case. And if you don't know certain other parallel passages, then it sounds pretty convincing. But when you've known the other passages, then you can see there's some real problems with what he's trying to teach. So that's why we want to have a comprehensive view of the scriptures. Dr. Sproul, of course, is very strong in systematic theology. The idea of systematic theology is that we look at everything the scriptures have to teach on a particular topic, and we understand that since it's all taught by the same Holy Spirit, that it is self-consistent, and that the different passages teaching on a certain topic are synergistic. They fit together, augment one another, and provide a holistic understanding of that area. And this is precisely where I think Dr. Sproul goes astray when it comes to eschatology. His eschatology is not systematic. It does not account for many of the different passages that shed light on areas that he's teaching. And in particular, we will see Dr. Sproul's teaching reflect the two primary commitments that preterism has. Now, preterism, I don't know if you've run across that term, but it basically means in the past. It's the idea that much of the prophetic passages, in fact, most of the prophetic passages in the scriptures, have already been fulfilled in the past. That would be preterism, and that's contrasted with my view, which would be futurism, which says that there's still many prophetic passages that have not yet come about in history, and they await a future fulfillment. But what we'll see is in the preteristic view, there's two primary commitments that drive their interpretation. The first is that when Jesus in Matthew 24 and 25, the Olivet Discourse, which of course also occurs in Mark and Luke, but that passage, when we look at Matthew 24 and 25, where Jesus spoke about the end of the age, the preterists are interpreting his words about the end of the age in a way that they insert a word into there, a phrase you'll hear them say. They talk about the end of the Jewish age. And what they mean by this is that the end of the age, many of the things that Jesus says about the end of the age, they don't take it to be the end of this age that we're in now, the end of the church age. They take it to be the end of the age of where the Jews still had a temple and the Jewish nation hadn't yet been judged for the crucifixion of their Messiah. And so the end of this Jewish age, as they put it, is then understood to be the fall of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., Now, obviously, that the fall of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. also figures prominently in Jesus' teaching in the Olivet Discourse. But their idea is that virtually everything Jesus says short of his second coming has to do with the fall of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. And because of that, that flavors how they're going to interpret passages, and in particular passages that on their face value clearly have not occurred in history, they're going to find ways of interpreting them in ways that they're not as literal, so that they can essentially shoehorn fulfillment back into the first century, and not just the first century, but prior to 70 AD. So one commitment of preterism is that the end of the age, or the age which Jesus predicts coming to a close in Matthew 24 and 25, that much of what is said there is the end of the Jewish age, which comes to a close in 70 AD with the destruction of their temple. The second primary commitment that preterism has is that various predictions are interpreted in such a fashion as to require fulfillment within the lifetime of those who heard Jesus. So predictions that he speaks, where he says, you, or this generation, they will never interpret those passages as being a prophetic you, that is, a statement to his hearers and those who come afterwards. But they're always going to interpret that as being the immediate hearers of Jesus and no further. To distinguish this, let me just offer this idea. In Deuteronomy 18:15, you will read in there how God says he's going to raise up for you, that is, for Israel, a prophet. And he uses the idea of the pronoun you is used in that passage. And of course, we understand that the you that he's talking to is Israel as a nation, and that we know that that ultimate fulfillment of that predicted prophet in Deuteronomy 18 is the person of Jesus Christ, who comes way, way later. And in the process, we know that the actual people who heard Moses speak that prediction died hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before that prophet came, that is, Jesus. So there's an example there of what I would call the prophetic you. In other words, the prophet is speaking to his listeners and their offspring, their descendants. So if I was a preterist and I took the preterist approach to Deuteronomy 18, I would say that all the rest of the Bible had to be reinterpreted in a way such that Deuteronomy 18:15 had to be fulfilled in the lifetimes of the people who heard Moses. Well, obviously, you can see there's a big problem with that, because in reality, the people who heard Moses were long gone before that fulfillment came. But this is the mistake that preterism makes, both in looking at timing texts that indicate that things will happen soon, or that the time is near, and they will interpret those almost all uniformly as indicating within a generation. Also, the phrase that Jesus uses this generation. They would take this generation in every case it appears, as always having to refer to the generation alive at the time of Christ's ministry, the people who actually heard him. And so places where he talks about, like on the Mount of Transfiguration, that certain people would not pass away until they see him coming in his kingdom, they would try to interpret that as his actual arrival fully in his kingdom rather than the Mount of Transfiguration. Some of them would. I'm not saying that RC does that, but you can see that this idea of how to properly interpret time texts and who is being spoken to, and whether it includes people beyond them, their descendants, or people walking in the same ethnic group, is critical to understanding prophecy. Well, because of these two primary commitments, number one, that the end of the age is really the end of the Jewish age, and that these various predictions with timing texts or concerning this generation have to always refer to the first century generation, the predictable result is that prophetic passages must have a first century fulfillment in view. And that makes sense, right? I mean, if only these things were to happen to the people who actually heard Jesus speak, then obviously they have to happen before all those people are dead. And what we end up finding when we look at this kind of teaching is, not only is there an effort to shoehorn everything into the first century, but there's also an overt bias against all things futurist or dispensational. And I don't know if you've encountered the term dispensational much, but it's kind of an unfortunate term, because I would consider myself a dispensationalist, And it has to do with how I interpret scripture and where that leads me. It doesn't really have to do with my focus on dispensations per se. But I will say that dispensational interpreters use a literal interpretive approach to scripture, where we are not worried about so much the number of dispensations or the transition between dispensations. I mean, that's part of the dispensational framework historically, but we're really interested in the interpretive framework that we use to understand the Bible. In particular, we make a distinction where the Bible makes distinctions. We put our emphasis on biblical covenants rather than theological covenants. We're clear to say that the covenants and promises that are made were meant to be understood in a literal way, or at least in a straightforward way. And we refuse to spiritualize passages to try and reapply them in ways that the original audience would never have understood. It's one thing for God to give progressive revelation and give an additional understanding or stretch what he said to include more, but the original statements he made had to be understood in the original context by the original hearers, and we're not going to allow those to be hijacked and redirected in a different way. And that makes me a dispensationalist. But as we'll hear from this first clip, we'll understand that R.C. has a very low view of people of my ilk. This particular clip is from October 29th of 2010, when a caller called into the Ask RC Renewing Your Mind radio broadcast, and this is a part of his response to a question about dispensationalism. The caller asks about the number of dispensations. RC makes some comments about that, which I don't have in this clip, but near the end he gives us an assessment of his view of dispensations, or dispensationalism, I should say. So let's stop now and take a listen to that clip.
I'm not a dispensationalist. I have never been impressed by that whole structure of biblical interpretation. I think it's aberrant. I think it's novel. It came to pass late in the 19th century in England and then was transferred to America and made tremendous inroads, particularly in American evangelicalism. But I think that it has a very faulty theology. Now, the biggest emphasis in dispensationalism is on its eschatology and its doctrine of the last days, and that's what attracts most of the people to it. Most of the people don't understand the ins and outs of the actual system of doctrine that this movement carried with it. I think it's a serious distortion of biblical Christianity, and I would urge you to take a hard, long look at it and make a critical analysis of it.
Well, as you can see, R.C. has a very low view of dispensationalism. You could hear him there. He says that he considers it to be aberrant. He calls it faulty theology. He says that dispensationalism seriously distorts biblical Christianity. It's a serious distortion of biblical Christianity. With that kind of an idea and an approach to dispensationalism, you can expect that his conclusions about prophetic passages are going to be wildly different than those who take the scriptures more at a face value. Also notice that he mentioned or claimed that dispensationalism was novel, that is, it's new. Well, I would admit that the formalization of a dispensational interpretation of scripture is generally associated with Darby, and that it's somewhat recent, but it's not that much more recent than covenant theology, which was not formalized really until the time of the Reformation. So, you know, to look at the whole biblical span of teaching from the time of Christ, where we're closing in on 2,000 years, you could say that dispensationalism is, you know, 200 years, maybe 200 to 300 years more new in its formal development than covenant theology, but both of them are little babes in relationship to early church history. So I think this is one of those cases, again, where he's trying to disparage the view and not really being fair about the fact that the formalization of covenant theology, which is his view, wasn't really that much earlier than dispensationalism came on the scene as well. So, having seen where he's coming in his mindset and tried to explain some of the commitments of preterism, I do also want to mention that I'm going to be approaching this by playing what amounts to little short segments of his audio presentation and then commenting on those things. And one of the reasons I'm doing that is that I want to stay away from problems of fair use. And there's a fair use doctrine that applies, or a fair use legal permission, if you will, that allows people to quote other books or other works, or to use recordings, snippets of recordings from other people that have been presented, and represent them for purposes of education or for purposes of commenting. And that's what we're going to do here. The unfortunate aspect of that, however, is that it could come across like I'm cherry-picking the easiest things to refute and then not including significant things he has to say on the same topic which make his case. So what I'm going to recommend is that you look at the links included in this presentation on our website and go ahead and go over to the Ligonier Ministries website and listen to the full presentation on each of the topics that we're going to touch on. And I think when you go over there and listen, you'll be at least able to see that even though I've slimmed down the main points to the real meat and bones, I'm not misrepresenting what he's trying to say, and I also believe I haven't really omitted any strong counter-arguments he has to some of the things I'm going to comment on. I'm just trying to reduce it down to the essentials and focus on some key points. So having said that, we're going to go now through these five different presentations that were given. And the first one took place on the 4th of November, 2013, at the Renewing Your Mind broadcast. And it concerns the Book of Revelation, and in particular, the date of the Book of Revelation. And what we're going to see here, this will be your first exposure to this if you've not dealt with preterism before. What you're going to see here is, in discussing the date of Revelation, Dr. Sproul's going to do as much as he can to shed doubt on the traditional late date for the writing of the Book of Revelation. And the reason he's going to do that is he has to make the case that the book was written before the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. And there's two reasons he needs to do that. One reason is he understands that the Book of Revelation is tied closely to the words of Jesus in Matthew 24 and 25 concerning the Olivet Discourse, where Jesus answers the questions, what's the sign of your coming and the end of the age and the destruction of the temple and so forth. He understands that the Book of Revelation is tied to some of the Olivet Discourse. And if he's going to make the case that the Olivet Discourse concerns the events of the fall of Jerusalem and the end of the Jewish age, then he also needs to make the Book of Revelation correspond to that same period of time. So he needs to shift the events of the Book of Revelation back and have them concern things prior to 70 AD, the fall of Jerusalem. The second reason he needs to do it is that he wants to find fulfillment for the Antichrist, the beast, in the person of Nero of Rome, the Caesar Nero, who committed suicide in 68 AD. And so he needs to, if he's going to have the beast of Revelation 13 be Nero, then he also has to bring the Book of Revelation back prior to the death of Nero. And so you'll see this as we go along. He's going to cast aspersions on the late date for the Book of Revelation, the traditional view, which was that it was written during the reign of Domitian, around 95 AD. So let's go ahead and listen to the first clip from the presentation on the Book of Revelation.
But there is a very pressing question about the Book of Revelation that is widely ignored among Christians. And that is the question of when the book was written. Because when we're seeking to understand any book of the Bible, we have to do our homework and look at the setting, the life setting in which it was first penned, and the dating of a book at that level becomes very important. We also want to know who wrote it and to whom it was written. Well, we know who wrote the book of Revelation. It is attributed to the Apostle John.
Well, as you can hear, R.C. is particularly concerned that we would pay attention to when the book of Revelation is written, and I'm in full agreement with that. However, I would also point out right away a little red herring or a yellow flag. He says that the date at which Revelation was written is widely ignored, and I don't think that's true. I think the book of Revelation is studied by Christians just like any other book of the Bible. They ask the who, when, why, when, how, where. All the W questions get asked. And so when people do study the book of Revelation, they don't ignore when it was written. In fact, most of the commentaries you're going to find, well, any decent commentary on any book of the Bible is going to have a big section up front discussing the date of the book of Revelation. And his problem there is he's trying to claim that we just don't think about it. Well, the fact is we do think about it, and it has been studied and discussed at length. And that's the problem is he doesn't like the traditional date. So he's trying to say to an unfamiliar reader of Revelation, you know, you've never really thought about this, but if it's not written at the date that you traditionally assume it is, then that could make a big difference. I think that's true. If that's true, that is important. But the idea that it's widely ignored, I don't buy that. In this next clip, we'll hear R.C. discuss the relationship of the Book of Revelation to the Olivet Discourse, and especially we'll hear the preterist position concerning the fall of Jerusalem.
Why is that question so important? Well, in our discussions of trying to understand the Olivet Discourse and its references that Jesus made about these things that were about to transpire within the time frame of the present generation, in which he prophesied the destruction of the temple, the destruction of Jerusalem, and his coming at the end of the age, which we've been wrestling with. And the moderate preterist position is, of course, as we've seen, that all of these things that Jesus predicted would come to pass within the time frame of one generation did in fact come to pass, coincidental with the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70 A.D.
So what we heard there is the preterist, the general outline of the preterist position. Notice that he's saying that everything that happened, or all the things that Jesus talks about in Matthew 24 and 25, had to apply to the immediate generation, the present generation that heard Jesus' words. They weren't meant to be understood as applying to people in general that he's speaking to beyond that time. Notice that the various things that he includes in there is Jesus' coming at the end of the age. That might surprise you initially if you've never come across that idea. But what he's referring to there, he's not talking about the second coming of Jesus, the one that we expect where he physically, bodily returns. What he's referring to there is what the preterists would call Jesus' quote, judgment coming, unquote, at 70 A.D. In other words, they believe that one of the comings of Jesus was his coming in judgment invisibly to destroy Jerusalem in 70 A.D. And I just want to mention here, by way of contrast, that one of the things that Dr. Sproul will criticize us heavily for as dispensationalists, Most of us who are dispensationalists also believe in a rapture of the church that's before the tribulation, or at least one before the second coming. And he will take us to task and criticize us very strongly because we believe in this coming of Jesus that he claims is nowhere to be found in Scripture, and we create this unbiblical coming of Jesus. Well, look what he's doing here. He's creating a non-bodily, invisible coming of Jesus in 70 AD to destroy Jerusalem. And I think if you search the Scriptures, you'll find it's a very difficult feat to try and tie any of Jesus' coming words into the 70 AD destruction. So the places where we see Jesus coming in the judgment in the day of the Lord, for example, as a thief in the night, the preterists would then apply that to 70 AD. So that's what he's speaking about there. He's saying that many of the things, the sign of the Son of Man and all these sorts of things that Jesus mentions in 24 and 25 of Matthew, that these were intended to be understood as the end of the Jewish age, which comes to a close in the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Notice also that he mentioned the moderate preterist position. What he's getting at there is that there is a brand of preterism called consistent preterism or full preterism, which goes so far as to say that all the timing texts, including those concerning Jesus' literal second coming that we're looking for in the future, that those had to be reinterpreted as happening in the first century. So the full preterist or consistent preterist position, where all the timing tests are understood in that uniform way, would deny the physical second coming of Christ. And of course, that's not an orthodox position. And so R.C. is distancing himself rightly from that. And that's why he's referring to the moderate preterist position, which is the position that he's holding and teaching here. In the next clip, clip number 3 from the Revelation, Book of Revelation teaching by Sproul, we're going to hear him describe the historic or traditional view of the dating of the book, which is in fact the late date.
The majority report in New Testament scholarship for a long time has been that the book of Revelation was written during the decade of the 90s, probably during the reign of the Emperor Domitian, which would have made it appearing well after the fall of Jerusalem. And so that would make it extremely unlikely that the prophecies contained within the book of Revelation had any reference immediately to these catastrophic events that Jesus had predicted on the Mount of Olives.
Notice that R.C. mentions that this is the traditional and the dominant view that's been held through history, that the book of Revelation was written during the decade of the 90s, well after the fall of Jerusalem and during the reign of Domitian. He goes on to make a statement, though, that I think should be strongly questioned. He says that if it was written during the decade of the 90s, then it's extremely unlikely that the prophecies in the book of Revelation had any reference immediately to Jesus' predictions on the Mount of Olives. Well, that's only true to the degree that you assume that Jesus' prediction on the Mount of Olives in Matthew 24 and 25 must be concerning the immediate listeners and the first century. So what he's done here now is he said, I know that Matthew 24 and 25 must absolutely refer to the people who lived at the time of Jesus. Therefore, the book of Revelation's irrelevant if it's not written during that same period. If it's written after the fall of Jerusalem, that makes it irrelevant to what Jesus said in Matthew 24 and 25. Well, this is just faulty reasoning. There's obviously the very real possibility, which many scholars take. Whether they're scholars or not doesn't matter, but many people who study the Bible take that Matthew 24 and 25 contains a mix of statements concerning the near future fall of Jerusalem, but also statements concerning the coming of Jesus at the end of this age, that is, his literal physical bodily resurrection. And now we know that to be pretty clear because in Matthew 24 and 25, Jesus goes to great extent to say, when they say that the Christ is in an inner room, don't believe that. When they say he's out in the wilderness, don't believe that. Because the sign of the Son of Man will announce his coming at the end of the age. Well, clearly what that passage is teaching is there's not going to be any ambiguity about Jesus' literal bodily return. That's going to take place in a way where it's unmistakable. So clearly there's at least one thing in that passage that does not apply to the first century. Jesus did not come in a way that every eye would see. He did not come in the sign of the Son of Man before 70 AD. So clearly, if we're going to make any sense of Matthew 24 and 25, we have to have at least one thing that he's predicted there did not concern the fall of the temple or Jerusalem, and that is his actual second coming. And even Dr. Sproul would not deny that Jesus' second literal physical bodily coming is still future. So for him to say that all of Matthew 24 and 25 has to occur before the fall of Jerusalem, and because of that, therefore the book of Revelation doesn't make sense if it's written after 70, that's just poor logic. There's nothing else to say about it. It's obviously possible that some of the things in Matthew 24 and 25 concern events that go far beyond the fall of Jerusalem that have to do with the end of this present age, and that likewise the book of Revelation includes those same events. Well, in this next clip, what we'll hear Dr. Sproul now talk about is what would happen if it turns out that the book of Revelation was actually written before the fall of Jerusalem, and how would that affect our possible interpretation of the book.
But then the question comes up, what if it wasn't written in the 90s, but was written before the fall of Jerusalem? Then that would put a whole new cast on understanding the immediate application of the content of the book of Revelation to the contemporaries of John who received that revelation. And there have been reputable scholars in the past who have argued for a much earlier date of Revelation, placing it in the decade of the 60s rather than in the 90s or even after the year 100, as some higher critics have placed it. That is to say that it was written before the fall of Jerusalem and with specific reference to those events that were going to come to pass in and around these catastrophic moments that had been predicted by the Mount of Olives discourse.
So here we see the basic idea that by relocating the book of Revelation back before the fall, in his view, it gives it a whole new cast of understanding. And now we could understand that the book of Revelation is primarily to be immediately applied to the contemporaries of John. And of course, he appeals to some reputable scholars who have held that view. Well, you can find scholars of every persuasion. And as you know yourself, Jesus, other than Paul, he didn't really appeal to scholars because scholars tend to get off in the weeds. Now, there's nothing wrong with scholarship if it's biblically informed, but we could appeal to scholars in support of anything. The fact is there's a lot of reputable scholars who have not held that view as well. So I don't think it's six of one or half dozen of another for us to go trotting around as scholars. Let's just look at the scriptures and at the historic evidence that there is. Notice, though, in his comments about the book of Revelation, he says, if it was written prior to 70, then the events in the book of Revelation concern catastrophic moments. Those were his words. Catastrophic moments that occurred in 70 AD. Well, if you're at all familiar with the book of Revelation, if you're going to say that the book of Revelation concerns the events of 70 AD primarily, then the book of Revelation is an enormous hyperbole. It is enormous stretch and exaggeration. Because obviously when it talks about the sea turning to blood, it talks about huge numbers of people dying, it talks about demonic oppression and punishment, it talks about the beast and all these sorts of things. And if you're going to put that all before 70 AD, then that basically turns the book of Revelation into something more like Alice in Wonderland, where on its surface it's not describing literal things. And then what you are going to end up doing now is spiritualizing much of what it says, because obviously the things it talks about, if you were to take them at face value, did not happen in 70 AD. So that means that in order to get them into 70 AD, you have to reinterpret them and understand them as literary license or an apocalyptic genre or some other way in which you deny the face value of the text. So in the next clip now, we'll have Dr. Sproul will clarify for us two types of evidence that are used in approaching a book or looking at a biblical book. When we're trying to figure out what date it was written at, there's a couple of different evidence, lines of evidence. One's internal and the other is external. So let's hear him talk about that now.
Now, anytime we face the question of dating a book in the Bible, we pay attention to two basic sources or two areas. First of all, we talk about the external evidence, and then we're concerned with the internal.
So what he's referring to there is external versus internal evidence. Now, external evidence is evidence that comes from outside the book. That is to say, things that the church fathers have said, or witnesses that knew the author and when he lived, or situations like that. In particular, external evidence often includes the writings of the church fathers. If they quote certain passages in a book, then we know that that book had to be written prior to the date that they quote from it, obviously. So that would be the nature of external evidence. Internal evidence is found within the book itself, which is to say, what does the book claim for itself? If the book says that it's written by John and doesn't qualify that name in any way, and we know that John was living later than most of the other apostles, then that's an internal piece of evidence that the author is actually John the Apostle. In the very least, someone named John. And other clues inside the text help us to understand or date when something occurred. And in some of the Old Testament books, we have very close chronological indicators where the prophet says in the such and such year of the such and such king, or the certain month of Nebuchadnezzar did this or that. Those are very close chronological internal evidence about when when the events in a book took place. So when we look at these two pieces of evidence, external and internal, generally we have to look at both. Now, one thing I want to mention is that where a book does not have precise chronological indicators in it, in other words, it doesn't say in the fifth year of King Jehoahaz or something along those lines, then the internal evidence can be very subjective. And the reason I say that is that two different interpreters can come and look at a book and look at the evidence inside it, what it mentions, and as long as they're not specific timing indicators or date chronological indicators, it's pretty subjective to say what pieces of the book are evidence about its date and which are not. Now, when it comes to external evidence, I want to mention that it is far more objective than internal evidence, especially in a book that doesn't have a precise chronological indicator. Now, obviously, we know the internal chronology of Revelation. One of the key things is John mentions in the first chapter that he's in exile on the Isle of Patmos. And I'll refer you to my Revelation commentary to look at that in more detail. But what we're going to find here next, in the next section, a couple sections from Dr. Sproul, is he's going to cite a really key external witness. Then he's going to cast aspersion on that external witness. And then he's going to go looking for internal evidence. And the internal evidence he's going to give is evidence from silence. He's going to make an argument from silence, which, of course, now, so what he's done is he's taken the objective external evidence, put big questions in our mind about what it really means, and then he's going to take internal evidence, which is essentially no evidence in this case. He's going to argue from silence to try and make a case about the date of the book. And I want to suggest, just before we even get into it, that the whole approach is wrong. Obviously, he's very motivated, because someone who's even-handed is going to come to this and say, external evidence is objective, it has a lot of weight. The internal evidence in this book, which is very scanty, is much more subjective, and it shouldn't have as much weight because it's lacking in real clear chronological indicators other than the fact that John was on the Isle of Patmos. So let's go ahead and listen to the next clip from Dr. Sproul, where he gives some testimony from Irenaeus and then reinterprets it. It's a very interesting passage. I think it sheds a lot of light on... This is a really good example of where a very intelligent man loses his moorings, he loses his compass, and starts following, he starts interpreting a text in a way that is clearly not the face value of the text, and yet he's very motivated to do so, and he doesn't see how unevenly handing, or how unevenly he's handling this evidence.
Now, one of the most formidable arguments for the late date of the book of Revelation comes by way of the testimony of the church father Irenaeus, who is one of the most respected fathers of antiquity, because he makes a specific reference to the apocalypse in his famous book Against Heresies. In fact, it's book 5 of Against Heresies. He says, and I quote, "We will not, however, incur the risk of pronouncing positively as to the name of Antichrist. For if it were necessary that his name should be distinctly revealed in this present time, it would have been announced by him who beheld the apocalyptic vision." Now, Irenaeus was born in the year 130 and died in the year 202. So he's a second century church father. And now he's talking about the mysterious character of the Antichrist and of the apocalyptic references to him, that he said, if it were necessary that his name should be known by us, that it would be distinctly revealed in this present time, it would have been announced by him who beheld the apocalyptic vision. Now what's he saying there? If we needed to know the name of the Antichrist, John would have told us, because he's the author and the one who beheld the apocalyptic vision. Now, here is the critical sentence. "For that was seen no very long time since, but almost in our day, toward the end of the mission's reign." Let me say it again. "For that was seen no very long time since, but almost in our day, toward the end of Domitian's reign." So here is the chief reason in terms of external evidence, because most of the later church fathers who dated Revelation late and during the reign of Domitian did so on the basis of Irenaeus' testimony. And the first glance at these words would suggest that what Irenaeus is saying was that the apocalyptic vision that John received took place during the reign of Domitian. And that obviously would have been after the fall of Jerusalem. Now, on the other hand, Irenaeus could be wrong. He's not an inspired writer. He could have his dates and times mixed up. However, there is a grammatical and literary question about this translation. And the question has to do with the antecedent of that. That which, again, was seen almost in our day toward the end of the mission's reign. Is he saying that John's vision was seen during the reign of the mission? Or is he saying that John, who received the vision, was seen as late as the reign of Domitian. Now again, church history indicates that of all of the disciples of Jesus, the one who lived the longest was John. In other words, if you do a technical analysis of this statement, the statement can mean either one. Either that the vision John received took place during the reign of Domitian, or that John was seen during the reign of Domitian, the one who could answer the question for us as to who was the Antichrist.
I think that's a very telling section from Dr. Sproul. And I hope you will agree. And if you have never heard that particular spin on the testimony of Irenaeus, I hope it caught your ear and you sat up in your seat and were wondering where he was going. And I think this is a good example of a scholar gone astray. He makes a statement. First off, he creates ambiguity where none exists. I think anyone who reads the statement of Irenaeus at face value, if you just sit down and read it, it's pretty obvious what it's saying. And so now he goes in and tries to create ambiguity where none exists. He says that a grammatical and literary question arises. Well, it only arises in the minds of someone who wants to discount it and reinterpret it. Anyone who reads the statement in its normative way is not going to be led in the direction of reinterpreting what's being said. And here's some reasons. And these are the kinds of reasons that a man like Sproul should be looking at. He's supposed to be a scholar. Why doesn't he look at things like this? For one, he says the question is the antecedent of that. Was it referring to the vision or was it referring to John? Well, let's look at a couple of simple approaches here. First off, the pronoun that is in the neuter gender. And it's not used of persons, but things. Clearly, in a sentence where you have a personal pronoun, John, a personal, you know, a noun, John, and then you have a pronoun later that's saying that, your preference is going to find a matching gender. You're going to find an antecedent of the pronoun that has a matching gender. And in this particular case, it's going to be the vision. It's not going to be John. It's very unnatural to call John a that. So just, even if you don't know any grammatical rules, your ear tells you that that doesn't refer to a person, but a thing. Besides that, besides this situation, notice the correlation between, it says, that was seen. The that, the antecedent of that, was seen. Well, seen means to view with your eyes. And what is that connected to elsewhere in the passage? Well, obviously, the vision. Don't lose fact that it says, it talks about a vision, and then it says, that was seen. Well, the vision is obviously tied to what was seen. Yeah, maybe John was seen too, but in the construction of that paragraph, there's no reason to pervert things. First off, by saying that that refers to the person. Secondly, by the fact that the thing that was seen is obviously tied to the vision. The word vision and seen, those two words are intentionally paired by the author. So when Sproul goes off and says, well, you know, after technical analysis, we can show that the statement could mean either thing. Well, yeah, maybe after some torture, the statement could mean either thing. But I think a normative reader or someone in a court of law would conclude that that is referring to a thing, the vision, and the fact that it was seen is correlation telling you that it's the vision. What was seen was the vision in the reign of Domitian, not John. And I think to incur in the listener's mind the question that this could be easily misinterpreted or it needs to be understood the other way is really stretching. He's having to really stretch to deny the external historical evidence that the book of Revelation is written way too late to concern the things in 70 AD. So when you see, so this is one of those points about teaching. Now, if you hear a teacher go off in a kind of a strange logic and a long stretch to try and make a point, the first thing you need to realize is when you hear that coming and you hear that occurring, that there's a motivation underneath there that isn't necessarily as obvious, but there's a motivation for why that teacher is going off in that direction, and that motivation is having a controlling effect on the interpretation rather than the actual text itself. Now in this next clip, we're going to hear some more evidence from Irenaeus where he refers to ancient copies of Revelation. So let's have Dr. Sproul explain the significance of that.
If we look further at the writings of Irenaeus, some other interesting facts emerge. One is that Irenaeus himself makes reference to, quote, ancient copies of the book of Revelation. You don't talk about something that was written in your own lifetime as an ancient manuscript. But had it been written 100 years earlier than he was writing, then obviously that appellation could justly be applied.
So the point he's making now is that Irenaeus referred to the book of Revelation, some copies of it, as being ancient. Well, there's several problems here, I think, with this argument. One is the word ancient could also be interpreted as old. And he makes a statement that Irenaeus would never, someone would not use the phrase or the term ancient copies if it was written in your own lifetime. Well, he just told us that Irenaeus lived from 130 to 202. Well, neither date for the book of Revelation places it in Irenaeus' lifetime. One would place it in AD 90, 95, the other around 60, 65. So, what we're talking about is a man who lived from 130 to 202. Well, let's pick the middle of that date roughly. You know, you've got 160 somewhere in there. He's talking about something that was written either 40 years before he was born or 70 years before he was born. Does Dr. Sproul seriously think that a difference of 30 years is going to make a difference about whether somebody calls it ancient or not? If it's written, you know, a significant time before he's born and he happens to call it ancient, we wouldn't call something like that ancient today, but Irenaeus called it ancient. Well, does it really make a difference of 30 years about whether he would use that term or not? I submit to you that if it's okay to call it ancient when it was written in 65, then it's also okay to call it ancient when it was written in 95. And to make a distinguishing between those two, as if 30 years is the difference between calling it ancient or not, is just a distractor. It's, again, grasping at straws. Now, in this next section, this next clip, we're going to hear R.C. give one of the other reasons why he's going to demand near fulfillment for all the things in the book of Revelation. This has to do with the time text, which we've also seen mentioned earlier. Let's hear him talk about that topic next.
Now, we've been concerned all along in this series with the time frame references of the New Testament. Let me remind you how the book of Revelation begins. Chapter 1, verse 1, reads as follows. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants, things which must shortly take place. And he signified it by his angel to his servant John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ, to all things that he saw. Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keep those things which are written in it, for the time is near. Over and over again in the book of Revelation, we have references to time frames of nearness. Let me just give you a quick summary. As I've already mentioned, those things which must shortly take place. Chapter 2, repent, or I will come to you quickly. Chapter 3, behold, I come quickly. Chapter 22 speaks of the things which must shortly take place. Chapter 22, surely I am coming quickly. Chapter 1, verse 3, the time is near. Chapter 22, verse 10, the time is at hand. And verse 119, write these things that are about to take place. Chapter 3, 10, the hour is trial, which is about to come on the whole world. Now, the Greek terms that are used there to talk about soon, near, at hand, all are time frame references in the language that have a very, very short time span. It's really stretching it to say that the Bible says that we have a revelation here that is given about things that are near at hand and are going to take place shortly, that you would expect a period of over 2,000 years to elapse after those time frame references are given.
Well, at first glance, this sounds pretty convincing, but it doesn't meet the biblical evidence. So, he has basically said that all these time texts have to be interpreted as meaning soon or shortly from a human perspective. But there's a lot of biblical evidence that there are passages that use those same exact words and phrases that cannot mean that. So, for example, when he gives these various passages in the book of Revelation, he's including passages such as Revelation 22, verses 7 through 9, which all partial preterists would interpret as the future bodily second coming of Jesus. So this creates a contradiction within Sproul's brand of preterism, since Revelation 22, 6 and following refers to the whole book of Revelation. How can he say then that every time one of these time texts occur, it has to mean the first century or things that have to occur in AD 70 or before? And yet at the same time, he's going to turn around and tell us, when he's in the book of Revelation, that chapter 22, where it talks about this soon return, the things which must shortly take place, and I am coming quickly. These are things where Jesus is talking about his second coming to the earth, his literal bodily second coming, the one that most people would just call the second coming. I'm sorry I have to qualify it so much to kind of differentiate it between this supposed cloud coming and judgment in 70 AD that these guys are always talking about. But I just want to make the point here that you understand that when he waves his hand over this timing text and says that they all mean it must be near at hand to the generation Jesus is talking to, then what he's also doing is he's including some passages that can only refer to the second coming of Christ, like in Revelation 1, where it talks about every eye will see him, even those who pierced him. Revelation 1, 7, that's a clear description of Christ's physical return to this earth. And he's trying to tell us that that passage, Revelation 1, 7, which incidentally is tied very closely to Zechariah 12, which we know for sure hasn't been ever fulfilled, he's trying to tell us that that has to be one of these soon timing texts. Well, my answer to that is either you have to put everything, if you're going to say the timing tests force you to take everything in the first century, then you have to put the second return of Jesus, the only one that we're waiting for him to come and reign, you have to put that back in the first century as well. Otherwise, you have to split those timing texts, and even the preterists do this. And this is the difference between a partial preterist and a full preterist. The reason a full preterist ends up being heterodox is because he's consistent with the timing text. He doesn't just say most of them have to be in the first century. He says they all have to be. And when he does that, he places the second coming of Jesus as having to be in the first century. Well, obviously, we never saw the sign of the Son of Man. We haven't seen Jesus take up his throne and reign. We haven't seen the earth judged. And so in order to get it into the first century, they have to spiritualize all these passages to say that, well, they don't literally mean what they say. Well, Dr. Sproul, to his credit, is not willing to put the second coming of Christ into the first century. But for him to claim that all the timing texts force an understanding in the first century is dishonest, Because there are some timing texts that even he will not allow in the first century that are identical. So I want to point out there how there's an inconsistency there. Also, I think it's interesting to notice that the prophecies bracketed by these shortlies include letters addressed to churches that existed two millennia ago in chapters 2 and 3, clear descriptions of Christ's physical return to this earth, Revelation 1:7, Revelation 19:19 through 27, and a prediction of his reign on earth for 1,000 years, Revelation 20, verse 4. So what we have to understand is that these shortlies and soon do not always mean close in time from the reference point of a human being listening to what's being given. A better understanding of these passages is it's from God's perspective, it's imminent from God's perspective, or that it's an event that once it starts will be rapid. Both of these approaches are a better way to handle these passages than to absolutely shoehorn everything it refers to into the 70 AD period. If we take that latter approach, we will wind up being consistent, full preterists, and we'll also be unorthodox. In other words, we'll be heretics. So even Sproul has to split them up. And so for him to maintain that those of us who look for future elements of these soon events, and as if we're, you know, not being true to the text, well, he's not being honest as far as there are some passages where he does the very same thing, and for good reason. So I think that whole line of argument has some serious flaws. Having said that, now let's look on to the next clip, which he's going to talk about now. He's going to move to the internal evidence in the book of Revelation, and he's going to make an argument from silence, and I think it's interesting to hear where he goes with this as well.
In addition to that, there are other internal references that we pay attention to, not the least of which is that so much of the language of the symbols of the book of Revelation is borrowed from the temple itself. It's replete with temple allusions throughout the book. And yet there's not the slightest hint anywhere in the book of Revelation that the temple is no longer standing. Now this is an argument of silence, but it's one of those pregnant silences that certainly an event as catastrophic to Christian Jewish history as the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple would be mentioned by an apostolic writing that took place after the event. And if Revelation was written in the 90s, and if it was the only New Testament book that was written after 70 AD, one would certainly expect some statement about the destruction of Jerusalem, had it been a past event. There's not a word. And the background, the illustrative background that shapes the whole character and content of the book is of a present temple. It's already there. It's still there.
Now, to his credit, Dr. Sproul recognizes that an argument from silence is a weak argument. So, as I said before, he's taken the external evidence, which is solid, cast aspersions on it, tried to reinterpret it in a very unnatural way, and now he's taken internal evidence, which in the book of Revelation is, there's a lot less of it, partly because of the visions that are being recorded are at a different place in time than when John's actually writing, so there's not that much to anchor the text in John's day, although we'll see a little bit further. There is a pretty strong indicator at one point coming up in Revelation 17. But so now he's turning and saying, well, there's a temple there still standing. Well, if you know anything about the futurist interpretation of that temple, there's nothing that says that it has to be standing at the time of John. In fact, there's a lot to suggest that it isn't the same temple, and in particular that's the temple where that is basically the place where the Jews have their final week, if you will, of worship prior to the second coming of Jesus. But in particular, mention of a temple doesn't require that it be in existence. And in particular, if you look at the book of Ezekiel, where the last portion of Ezekiel is talking about the millennial temple, certainly when Ezekiel is writing, there is no temple standing in Jerusalem. So to say that the mere mention of a temple requires that that be the temple that's presently in existence, I think is a big assumption. It's possible, certainly, but it's not required. Also, notice that he's making an argument for silence where he says that, well, look, if Revelation was written after 70 AD, and if it's the last book to be written, certainly John would have mentioned the fall of Jerusalem. I mean, think how significant that is. Well, I would beg to differ with that. I think he's making a mistake there of attributing the motive for writing to John. I think it's very clear. If you look at chapter 1, John is told to write the things that are and the things which are coming and etc. In Revelation 1:18, he's given instructions. Basically, it's a dictation situation where he's being shown things and told what to write. This is not like the book of Luke or the book of Acts, where Luke does an investigation and a lot of the inspired motive for the book is coming from Luke's historical interest in recording objectively the facts. No, this is an apocalypse. This is like more like the book of Daniel or some of the passages in Ezekiel and Isaiah, where the prophet is shown some incredibly unusual things and just records what he sees. And why do I say that? Well, that means that there is almost none of this that comes about from John's own motive. This is not an epistle. This is a vision and a revelation. John has very little interest or concern in how or what is being written. That is coming from Jesus and from the visions. He's only being a secretary, if you will, writing down what he's seeing and what he's told to write. So it comes back to the Holy Spirit. If the Holy Spirit and God is giving this prophecy, and it is in the mid-90s, and it concerns things that don't have anything to do with 70 AD, then why would it not mention 70 AD? I mean, so again, it's an interesting attempt to say, well, the book is probably before 70 because it doesn't mention it. But again, I think it's a very weak argument. There's nothing at all in the way that the vision was given that would suggest that John is the one that's coming up with the ideas about what should or shouldn't be written. Now, in this next clip, we'll find one of the key timing indicators in the book of Revelation being discussed, and this has to do with chapter 17 in the book. And what we'll see is that there's seven hills that relate to seven. Well, we have to talk about it more after we hear what Sproul says, but just to prefix it to say that there is a dating indicator there that I absolutely agree with R.C. on, but his interpretation of it differs significantly. And so we'll look at that next.
Now, in Revelation chapter 17, there is a segment of the text which is critical to pinpointing the dating and the timing of the book with respect to internal evidence. And let me call your attention to chapter 17, where we read these words. But the angel said to me, "Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast that you saw was and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was, and is not, and yet is. Here is the mind which has wisdom." Now here we get an internal translation or explanation of the symbols. "The seven heads are seven mountains upon which the woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time." And he goes on to describe the beast and so on. Now, the question, two questions here. First of all, what is the city of seven hills? It's possible that that is an obscure reference to Jerusalem itself. But in all of antiquity, the most famous nickname for Rome was the city on the seven hills. And so if the author of Revelation is describing Rome here, it goes on to speak of the kings of Rome, and some scholars object to that, saying that the Romans didn't call their emperors kings. They called them emperors rather than kings. But in any case, we read here in the text that there are seven kings, five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come. Now, what does that tell you? It tells you that the book is being written at the time of the sixth king. Because five have gone, there's another one that is to come, but the sixth is now. That is, there's a present reference to the sixth king, and the sixth king who reigns over the city with the seven hills. Now, the question is, who is the sixth king? And we would ask that question by saying, who is the sixth emperor of Rome?
Well, there's a number of things that could be said about the line of reasoning in this passage. I will start out by saying I do agree with Dr. Sproul that at the time that the vision is being seen by John and he's writing it in the book of Revelation, the sixth king is reigning. That is for sure a chronological indicator. But, of course, that leaves a lot of questions about which kings are we talking about. And obviously, depending on which sequence of kings you pick, that changes things quite a bit. And, of course, Sproul believes that the key is found in counting the Caesars of Rome and coming up with Nero. Also, he's quick to attribute the seven hills as being the hills of Rome. Never mind the fact that that word hills can also be translated mountains, and in fact is called mountains in several of the translations. But I think what's especially interesting, and this is something I deal with in more detail in my Revelation commentary, is that he uses a translation of Revelation 17:10, which is slightly unreliable. And why do I say that? Well, the translation he uses sounds like, as far as I can tell, it's the New King James Version, which is actually my favorite translation. But in Revelation 17:10, it has a little serious flaw. It's a small flaw in the translation, but it's a pretty serious one if you're trying to do interpretation of prophecy. Revelation 17:10 talks about, in 9 it says, "Here's the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. They are also seven kings." So it differentiates between the mountains and the kings. So it says the seven heads that are on this beast are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And then it differentiates those and says there are also seven kings. And what we see, of course, is Sproul does exactly that. He takes the seven mountains as being the seven hills of Rome, and then he talks about, well, who are the seven kings that are separate from these seven hills? Well, the New King James and the King James both translate Revelation 17:10 in a way that infers that the seven kings are different than the seven mountains, but in fact they are not. The King James says, "And there are seven kings." The New King James Version says, "There are also seven kings." But in fact, if you look at the underlying Greek in that passage, even in the Textus Receptus, which is the Greek text that was used for the King James, the word there cannot be translated "there are." It is the Greek word that means "they are." There's a big difference between "there are" and "they are." And the Greek says, "They are seven kings." In other words, the seven mountains, they are seven kings. The seven mountains are not the seven hills of Rome. They're not separate from the kings. The mountains are biblical representation, which we see in other parts of Scripture, that refer to kingdoms as mountains. So, what I find especially interesting in this particular teaching by R.C. is that the Bible that he is connected most closely with, which is the Reformation Study Bible, which is the English Standard Version that they use for that reference study Bible, it doesn't read the same as the New King James. The English Standard Version, which is the text preferred for the Reformation Study Bible, clearly says they are also seven hills. In other words, the seven mountains, they are also seven hills. So one of the questions, of course, that comes up is why the seven heads are, if the seven heads are said to be seven mountains, and the ESV says they are also seven kings, why all of a sudden are we going over to the New King James Version in this particular case and ignoring all the other versions and their translations? The ESV says they are also seven kings. The NASB says, and they are also seven kings. The NIV says, they are also seven kings. The Net Bible says, they are also seven kings. The Holman Christian Standard Bible, HCSB, they are also seven kings. The hills are seven kings. So one thing we right away becomes a big question is, right away saying the seven hills are the seven hills of Rome, I think are a big, there's a big question about that, because biblically the seven hills represent actually seven mountains, which are the seven kings. So connecting them with the city is dubious right off the bat. There isn't any definite connection with the city, or at least it's not given in the text. It's the woman that is said to be the city of Babylon. She is riding on a beast with seven heads. The seven heads are seven kings, and they're also seven hills. So to turn around and say that the seven hills are connected with the city when it's the harlot riding the beast that's the city is to drag in a city connection that's not actually given in that text. And it's kind of playing fast and loose with what the angel actually says. So the hills, mountains refer to kingdoms. Now he also mentioned in the text that the sixth king rules over the seven hills. That's a complete assumption. Nowhere in the text does it mention in any sense that the kings rule over the hills. The kings are represented by the hills. The mountains, biblically, represent kings and their power. So, the other big assumption that he makes is that the kings are all Roman. That these seven kings, of which the sixth is presently ruling, are all Roman kings. They're all from the Roman Empire. Well, that's a big assumption as well, because the beast with seven heads, and the seven heads are the seven hills or mountains, and the seven mountains, they are seven kings. This beast with seven heads has a lot longer pedigree than the upstart Roman Empire. The beast with seven heads is related to the visions of Daniel. The woman who rides this beast is the mother of harlots. And if she's the mother of harlots, her harlotry goes back to the origin of idolatry. And that means that her ride on the beast has gone on for a lot longer than just Rome in the time of Jesus. In fact, it argues for a historic origin much earlier than the first Caesar. So the first head on the beast would hardly be thought to be the first Caesar if the woman's been riding the beast throughout history. And in fact, Revelation 12 gives us that idea, because the beast with seven heads was standing ready to devour Christ at his first coming. And clearly, the beast, and referred to as the serpent of old, is tied back in historic influence all the way back to Genesis 3:15. And so in my commentary, this is a bigger topic than we're going to undertake here, but I refer you to my commentary, especially in Revelation chapter 12. I think you can make a strong case that the beast with seven heads, his origin in history is well earlier than the first Caesar. So deciding to take the seven heads as seven Caesars is dubious to begin with. But let's hear now more about how R.C. proposes to count these Caesars to arrive at his conclusion of who the sixth ruling king is at the time John is writing.
So if we start with Julius Caesar as number one, Augustus number two, Tiberius three, Caligula four, Claudius five, who's six? Nero. Would indicate that the book was written during the reign of Nero.
Well, I've omitted some of the full lengthier discussion that he makes about the different ways of counting the Caesars. Suffice it to say there are different ways to count the Caesars. So that sheds some question upon coming up with the sixth being Nero, because when you look at how many Caesars there were really, and whether or not you should include Julius, because he wasn't necessarily called formally an emperor, you end up with a lot of variations, and he has kind of swept all that under the rug, or at least he's alluded to it slightly, but kind of made one argument that, well, it must be Nero. But another scholar who has studied the book of Revelation has this to say instead. He says, to be sure, there have been many attempts to fit the date of Revelation into the emperor lists of the first century, but immediately there are admitted problems. Where do we begin? With Julius Caesar or Caesar Augustus? Are we to exclude Galba, Otto, and Vitellius, who had short rival reigns? If so, how can they be excluded except on a completely arbitrary basis? A careful examination of the historic materials yields no satisfactory solution. If Revelation were written under Nero, there would be too few emperors. If under Domitian, too many. The original readers would have had no more information on these emperors' succession lists than we do, and possibly even less. How many Americans can immediately name the last seven presidents? Furthermore, how could the eighth emperor, who is identified as the beast, also be one of the seven? And I'll talk a little bit more on that in a minute. I think that's a very significant question. But let's just assume for the sake of argument, let's go along with Dr. Sproul and assume that Nero is the sixth, just for the sake of argument. Well, what we've already seen is that the heads are related to the kings. The heads are mountains, and they are also kings. So the question then is, if Nero is the sixth, who is the seventh? More than that, how is it that it says that the seventh one disappears and reappears? And we see that. Notice that it says, starting in Revelation 17:10, there are also seven kings, and I've argued that that should read, they are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. The beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth and is of the seven and is going to perdition. Well, we're going to hear a little bit later, Dr. Sproul is going to argue that the beast was Nero. But he just got through telling us that the beast was the sixth king. But the record in Revelation 17 says there are a total of eight kings. There are seven heads, which are seven kings, and the seventh comes out. Out of the seventh comes an eighth, who is and is not, and is going to perdition. And I think when you look at that in more detail, what you'll find is that the beast arrives on the scene as the seventh head. He's overthrown, and then comes back again as the eighth. He is of the seventh. He also shows up as the eighth in his revived or restored position, and he's the one that's the son of perdition, who's going to perdition. Well, obviously, if you make Nero the sixth, then who is the seventh? And if the seventh is the beast ends up being the seventh and the eighth, essentially, then what do you do with that? How can you make Nero be the sixth, the seventh, and the eighth? Essentially, what you have to say is, the more biblical answer is, that the beast is of the seventh, He's from the seventh kingdom. He's of that seven, and he becomes the eighth when he's restored in his final reign. Now that might sound confusing because you probably, unless you've gone through Revelation a lot, but I just point you to my commentary in the book of Daniel and also the commentary in Revelation, which talks a lot about the heads and their sequence. But the main point I want to make about here is that Nero can't be the sixth and also the eighth. Also, we have no record how Nero disappears and reappears, which is what we're going to see about the beast. It says that the beast was and is not, and he's of the eighth, is himself also the eighth and is of the seventh. So this whole business of how do you handle beyond six doesn't match Nero at all, especially since he committed suicide. He's never reappeared again. And also the reappearance of this final king as the eighth is associated with his identity as the beast. So Nero can't both be number six and number eight. I think that's a serious problem right there for this whole idea by Sproul. And we're going to go on to some other topics next, but what I do want to suggest is if you have time, go ahead and listen to the full broadcast by Dr. Sproul and with some of these ideas in mind. And especially you'll see the related broadcast concerning the beast. When you listen to that, you'll hear him make the case again that he believes the beast is Nero. And keep in mind that he's trying to put Nero into Revelation 13, but also here as the sixth king in Revelation 17. And the fact is that the beast in Revelation 13 is the eighth head, not the sixth. I think there's a fundamental error he's making there. Anyway, I hope this has helped you in relation to the book of Revelation and being able to understand some of the things that R.C. Sproul does that don't really line up with the text, or where he tries to cast aspersion on the witness of history, which is not really confusing, and he tries to make it confusing. And I want to suggest to you that he clearly has an agenda, and that agenda won't permit the book of Revelation to speak about the future, where it's pretty clear that the events in the book of Revelation have never taken place, and if they have, the Bible's a farce. I don't think anyone could take the Bible seriously when we try to claim that the book of Revelation, most of it occurred in 70 AD. I think the world missed it. people historically had no idea all these cataclysmic events were taking place in 70 AD. Yes, it was cataclysmic for Jerusalem, but not in the sense of the signs that are given in the book of Revelation or in Matthew 24 or 25. This preterist interpretation of these passages just twists and distorts and tortures the text to make it say 70 AD when there is no fit.